The Rhetoric Warriors podcast has returned with another episode of the Rhetorician Files. I think this is number 8 with Dr. David Payne. As we go through and just call the guys who are sitting around their houses, no longer lecturing. The purpose here is, again, always to do some teaching about the world of rhetoric. Maybe it's just roaming the national language parks, you know, just stopping and camping here and there, checking out a waterfall.
Coliseum. These are the national parks.
Yeah. Word waterfalls. We're just sticking our cups into word waterfalls here and there. I am Dr. Dan French, friendly neighborhood rhetorician, late night Hollywood comedy writer, all the things. The podcast does 3 things. I talk to comedians about politics. I convert conservatives because I believe they need it. And I bring in pro-influence theorists and influencers to teach the world. The Rhetorician Files really is just me grabbing as many rhetoricians as I can. I need to expand maybe the list. Like,
I guess I'm just so grabbable, huh?
Well, it's perfect. Like, I got Hart on early, but he was so reticent and so you know, Rod Hartish, that I'm like, you know, he was doing me a big favor by talking to me. And I'm like, hey, Hart, come on. It was super fun though, but it really is this resource of people, you know, rhetoricians and people who have all this training and knowledge sitting around and nothing to do with it anymore. So,
well, that is a fact about the knowledge base. We academia seems to shed them like skins. So many different vocabularies, and unless you're stepping back to sort of chart the continuity.
Well, and we've talked about this before. It's always bothered me that huge body of knowledge that ends up landing in one person over and over again, and it's spread out into all these people. It really, maybe you write a book, maybe you do some lectures, write a paper in there, but it really doesn't get captured and transmitted out to the world. So podcasting seems like a great way of doing that. I don't know.
Well, there's no reward structure in the production of knowledge, academic knowledge itself. In fact, the reward system gets new vocabulary and develop an insight. So, you know, or what might appear to be one.
Well, so, it goes back to, you know, the Hannah Arendt quote about our inheritance is left to us by no testament. Mm-hmm. You know, so I have all this knowledge base in people, and it never does really get out to the world where they can use it. So,
but it's also, you know, it's also the technology of knowledge. New is always better and improved. And
well, that's a consumption mentality too. That something I talk about a lot when I do rhetoric training is when every time you move up to a new consumption layer, like Amazon, the Amazoning of humanity now. Those expectations, like my son, you know, gets probably, I don't know, 60% of his stuff from Amazon, often 2-hour delivery, definitely 1-day delivery. And he tracks it and watches it, enjoys doing that process. He's kind of fascinated by who's bringing it and all this stuff, but it happened just instantly and effortlessly. And now that's transferred over into the consumption of information. So.
Sure. I guess don't get me started on academics, but I think maybe academics are really more production focused without regard to consumption at all. So,
yeah,
the journal article builds the vita and gives you the list, regardless whether anybody reads it or, you know, it's there are attempts to quantify those sorts of things, but they're all pretty tortured.
Yeah, there are dark alleys in all these.
So it's a supply side economy that's actually working. It's like the old line, the only place left on the globe where communism is working is in the American Academy. And the same thing with supply side economics, I guess.
Yeah, good point. Well, today we are going to wander a little differently. We've been talking recently about propaganda and sort of exploring that as a topic. Thought we'd jump over to something else that we both tend to study a lot and find very interesting, which is story. And I jumped into story very early on in rhetoric. I've always been fascinated by how stories work. And just to launch, here's a story. Like when I was 21 and moved to Austin, I lived in a little apartment complex called the Redwood North. And it was pretty cheap. And I didn't really understand why until I moved in there because I rented it. And then I came down here until I moved in and saw next door was a place called the Flight Path Cafe. And I realized very quickly I was going to get thundered constantly during the day because I'm literally in the flight path of the Austin airport. And, you know, I could see people, I could look up and see what they were being served, you know, in the airplanes as they were coming down, you know, right over top of my apartment. And you had the similar flight path line.
I did.
In Austin.
We looked at our house on Sunday and it was very quiet. Got moved in, and then come Monday morning, the DC-10 starts rolling down.
Right? Like you don't, like they don't the show you. They know the realtor know to not show you during the landing times.
I guess so.
But you soundproofed your place. I remember one of the first times I came to your place.
Well, I tried. Yeah. It had some help, but still.
So we both
were thinking about that the other day. We used to have when we would talk, we had kind of an informal local rule that when the airplane starts booming, you just simply stop and wait for it to go by and then resume your sentence. And everybody soon learned this conversational rule. It was.
Yeah. I used to tell people when they caught one on phone calls, I'd always say like, hey, just so you know, when the planes go by, there's no reason to talk. So.
Right. Yeah.
So there's a launch story. There's an Austin, old Austin story back when the airport was basically right in the center of the city. But they moved it out. So let's launch in. Academic approaches to story, life approaches to story. In some ways, when I look at this, like story through entertainment, because the media, you know, basically lives on story. So every day I'll start to work and I'll work for a while and then I'll turn on the TV so it's in the background and I replay movies that I've watched many times. Like I rewatched There Will Be Blood yesterday in the background with Daniel Day-Lewis just because I like to watch that guy act. And the story is just around me. I'm not really paying attention to it, but I'm so comfortable with it now. And I think most of the world is because you've got this constant access to this amazing list of movies and stories. And they've just been integrated into our lives through the media, that structure.
Absolutely. More than ever before, I think. If you think about, you know, before television, how much narrative structure did the average citizen get? And I think and this was 30 years ago, I guess, when I culled this statistic, but... something like by the time a child comes of age in the United States, they've experienced 30,000 TV and movie narratives. How many times does a child growing up today watch New York get destroyed by some kind of monster or another, right? How many times have we replayed to, you know, the 911 disaster in, you know, the Avengers and Godzilla? I mean, on and on and on. I was talking with my friend yesterday about how I'm just tired of that. You know, that big, because it transforms who our superheroes are and what's required of them. You know, Superman can't just fight some property crimes, catch some bank robbers, you know, deal with a colorful bad guy. He's got to be this depressed, dour, hanghead kind of psychologically troubled individual, him and Batman both. And every time they got to deal with total apocalypse. So.
Yeah, the stakes, I mean, you know, media stories play with high stakes. It's one of the things you're taught as a media writer is that you've got to get stakes into your story, no matter what it is. So like you mentioned, Godzilla versus King Kong, you know, which has just come out.
The most recent installment.
Yeah, and I, you know, I'm friends with the guy who wrote that. I knew him in Hollywood, and he's a really great writer. He's one of the top sort of Hollywood screenwriters. And just the fact that watching that movie and the way they incorporated all the superhero tropes. Like it's not just Godzilla appearing or, you know, King Kong in the jungle. They're now in the city, destroying the city, which is what always happens in the Avengers movies now. Like they destroy an entire city. Like it was in Hong Kong, I think, that would have killed 6-7 million people.
Oh yeah. Yeah. But it's also all the recent Superman stuff and the Batman stuff. For sure. I thought the most recent one had a little, not to get a little Pacific Rim flavor to it.
It did, for sure.
Which was one of the better action versions of this, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the other things you get in story. And so I come from story from two different perspectives. I was in story production. And so I've been exposed to a lot of the pressures that are put on you in story. So to make it constantly stimulating. So you have huge stakes like that. And, you know, you have to sanitize it because you can't have massive death. I remember watching Westworld. Have you watched Westworld?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And just because it was cyborgs, I guess, they figured they could just show bodies everywhere. And I got so tired of seeing piles of bodies, you know, and just constant death and dismemberment. And I couldn't watch it anymore. I'm like, this has gone against the trope.
That's interesting. Sure. And how, you know, if you just think of the amount of destruction that one has witnessed the kinds of movies that we're talking about. And then, of course, the latest two-part ending, I guess, I hope it's the ending of the Avengers franchise, right? With Thanos destroying, killing half the people on the globe, and then...
There's no end.
And then bringing them back. I mean, and once again, if you're thinking about, as I often do, our heroes and villains, these heroes only pull even. They don't really solve the problems. And I think maybe there's something less than cathartic about that, right? That that's why they're all bedraggled and tired and right?
Yeah.
Joyless heroes, is because the best you can do is sort of break even and wait for the next total.
Yeah, it's interesting. I tried to watch Tenet. I don't know if you've seen that yet or not.
But have not.
It's basically bad James Bond. Like, it's throw a little sci-fi into James Bond, but the character, even the character, the guy, the main character, they just call protagonist. Like, that's his name, you know, like the guy's trying to be so self-aware about story, but even he just seems tired of the structure. Like, there's a point in there where he says piece of dialogue where he's been explained, you know, how the world's going to be destroyed. And he literally says it in this kind of dismissive, tired old trope way of, what, nuclear war? Is it going to be nuclear war? And she's like, no, not this time. This time it's going to be some kind of time. She's like, this is worse. It's time destruction. Like, the future is coming back to kill us. It's like, what? Because they're always trying to get higher stakes. And at some point, what do you do?
Well, I think, you know, one way I go at this is with the old Burkean language of vocabularies of motives. So, what motivates our heroes is significant, right? And I think that undergoes change, and I think that is a cultural reflection. I think, you know, in the whole digestive track of this narrative culture of who are these gangsters? Right? What are the Sopranos? You know, what's motivating these people? How do they express that? What becomes good and bad to own as motives? And so I think over time, at least that's one of my approaches, is to look at. I was reminded in a conversation recently that, you know, the quality of our villains is also, you know, maybe we don't want them terribly complex. And at least my conversational partner was saying, really, really tired of these agents of chaos villains. And if you look at the bad guys, like the joke, the most recent version of the Joker or the Star Trek bad guys, they're kind of mirror images of terrorists, or at least what we ideologically want to think of as terrorists. They're just doing it to cause disruption. And right. The old Joker was trying to rob banks and just, you know, whatever, get back at Batman or whatever, have fun. But now, you know, it's, I just want to cause as much, he doesn't care about money. I just want to cause as much trouble as possible. So I getting kind of tired of that bad guy, and the villainy there, really. And I think this is the, you know, back to these narratives that we're talking about, that they really just want to create mass destruction. And then if you look at, you know, how does that vocabulary of motives get played out in other little mini dramas? You know, the spate of shootings and things like that. I'm not saying they caused them. I'm saying there is continuity there. That somehow this is an expressive mode to just, for whatever set of reasons, feel as though you have some justification for just disrupting the system.
Right. Well, and
that gets owned in a number of ways, I think, politically and culturally. So.
Well, and you know, this is one of the things about the Burkean quote of these literature's equipment for living. It's prognostic for living. It's like it's prescriptive. It's like, oh, here are some options for how you might handle this.
Well, I think that's one of the functions of stories is you see what solves the problem and what doesn't, what gets rewards and what doesn't. So there is that is, I think, where a lot of the rhetoric of story is contained. And that's why a lot of the readings of story, I think, are less than satisfactory. If we just look at, you know, what the problem is and say, oh, well, you know, it's giving us too much this or too much that, too much violence or too much of content, and don't look at what happens. How does it resolve itself? What is shown in this narrative structure to be resolving or rewardable or honorable or heroic? Right. You have to look at the outcomes too, because we are capable of reading.
Right.
Well, we've never had such a trained culture in reading these things. So,
well, look at the difference in the, Dark Knight Rises Joker versus the most recent Joaquin Phoenix Joker. Like the recent Joker became what I would call a victim villain, like because he was victimized so much by culture and by, you know, all these things, it justified him becoming a villain. And he may have taken it too far, you know, which is what makes you a super villain. But the fact that they can now give some justification for the villainy, like they can actually build a backstory behind it. So it's not just, oh, I want money or I want cause disruption. I'm getting justice for how I've been victimized.
Sure.
And that plays over perfectly into all the, you know, right wing, we are storming the Capitol because this has been stolen from us and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything especially new about that. Maybe there's a new kind of degree of intensity in some way.
Yeah, the depth of it, like the fact that it has a psychological exploration behind it.
Dr. Bell and I noticed some years ago that all these serial killer movies, they always invent some sort of pathology for the male serial killer that, you know, he was troubled as a youth, you know, something went wrong, whatever. But for the female killers, they were just plain evil. You know, there's none of this backstory that says she was hurt as a child and this is how she's expressing it. No, she's just bad. So it's back to the, you know, what's motivating and what are the consequences. So each of these, you know, these story worlds are what you've called the mythos, really represent little moral universes, and there are little rules to these moral universes. And I think that's part of how we exercise moral discourse and see values enacted.
When I watch sort of what's happening like this past week, the Republicans in Arizona have got enough legal cover to recount the votes all by themselves. They're looking for villainy. They're looking for victimage because they can't build the story without it. Like there's just the problem that they run into, I think, with the big lie about the election is that there's too much logos in it. Like it's been vetted in too many ways. And so they can't just turn it into that sort of amorphous story. They keep getting pulled back to courts and actual proof and all that, which just decimates the story.
So it's kind of that story. In fact, there was an alternative headline this morning saying, you know, the whole stop the steal thing is starting to fizzle. And I think that it eventually runs into the brutalized by a gang of rowdy facts, I guess. another beautiful narrative brutalized by rowdy facts. You know?
Exactly.
So there is this recalcitrance of the, you know, in this case, there is a count there. And unless you invent these other elaborate explanations for why the count, that's why there's some lovely, you know, some lovely story border skirmishes about, you know, the company that makes the machines suing these people. That's a pretty strong narrative counterpunch, I think.
Yeah. Right. Well, but it does. It's you're watching these two, again, my world of these two Colosseums fight with each other. Like to just turn it into story, I remember with the villainy of Hillary Clinton, the fact that she had hidden something and there was a conspiracy and there was a cover up, and it played into so much of the political narratives.
Sure.
And she wasn't able to give counter evidence by showing the actual, she would claim that, oh, these were just innocuous personal emails, but then they got rid of them. And then she was lost because she could not fight with logos at all.
Well, yeah, she did. She couldn't, even if she had, right, the suspicion created. And I think that was, at least as I recall, a number of conversations with people, that was just the idea that the seed that got planted, that there was something in those to be revealed. Mm-hmm. And then all it took was kind of the Comey, we're going to be looking again. And I think, you know, given the timing of it and the other, all the 84 other factors that made the difference, this was enough to make the difference, right?
And it was a story assassination. Like, she got pulled over into a character and she did not know how to get out of it. She couldn't get that knife out of her back. She couldn't find the right, you know, counter character. And she kept trying, hey, I've been the defense secretary. I've been this. But there wasn't enough moral character for her to shove off this.
Well, and there was a history there of a couple of decades of scandal about the Clintons. So she had already been turned into this character. That fire needed to be stoked. But if you look at also, you know, the narrative industries, the National Enquirer continued to, you know, pump those stories. The Russian propaganda continued to pump those stories.
One of Biden's advantages, right? The fact that he's been around for so long and he's only got a couple of minor stories, you know, to slander him with. They tried to pull his son out, you know, to slander him by association.
Right.
None of the stuff sticks because he's got too much of a logos history. There's been too much evidence, 40 years.
Oh, I know. And, you know, I mean, hero son, son that gets cancer, you know, serves in the military. So almost everything's, you know, nullified in story on story combat.
That's really what it is in politics. It becomes story on story combat,
sure,
right?
Sure. Once again, can you nullify? And once again, you know, back to the Trump-Clinton election, there's just so much offsetting there of negative to negative that, it became the least satisfying election in history. I mean, there was no catharsis and harvesting that yet today, I'm sure.
When you mentioned, you know, Trump as the monomyth, I found this really interesting. Like, I think Trump moved up into mythic structure. And so all the documentary stories about him, the reality-based stories, all the real world, doesn't matter. Like, there's a mythic structure for Trump. It is that kind of Reagan-esque, come in and save America. You know, it's built in big mythic terms. And it withstands all the small stories coming at him.
Well, sure. I mean, it bespeaks, I guess we could think about this as casting, right? The story need in the drama that is politics and the political election, we're going to enact that ritual structure no matter what. So we're really casting people into this, right?
Right.
So there's a need for that casting. So I think that's what helps. And all of this doesn't have to emanate from the candidate themselves. So I guess the ultimate example of that is in the movie Being There, right? Where the mentally challenged gardener eventually is spoken about in such a way. And it's that they, you know, at the end of the movie, they're saying there's only one person who can do this, and that's Chauncey Gardner, right?
Right.
And I think Trump is the inheritor of some of that kind of casting, if we look at the monomythic structure, or what was known as the American monomyth, a couple of 35, 40 years ago almost, Jowett and Lawrence wrote the book on the American monomyth, but that if you look at the single story in American popular culture that gets replayed over and over and over again, it's that it is in their analysis a kind of a quasi-religious form that is played out in these popular culture narratives of who the hero is and what makes them the hero. that they always, and if you look at our, we talked about our popular culture, our, if we look at our detective stories and our hero stories, it especially science fiction, I think is so clear just because it's so elemental in most ways. We tend to believe or express the belief, personify this belief in that this literature and lore, that being a good citizen, being a member of the community, keeping harmony around is the moral thing to do, but it makes you impotent. Nobody, you know, if you're obeying the rules and being a good citizen and working in cooperative, democratic ways, that's the right thing, but it also makes you unpowerful to fight evil, because evil is individual, it's random, it's right, plagued by a different set of rules. And so the monomythic structure is that when evil either grows up within a community or invades from without, outside the community, problem occurs, and this calls forth the hero from the outside. So the monomythic hero comes from outside, in this case, Washington, right? Tends to have a disguised identity, mysterious origins. If you think about the Lone Ranger or Superman or any, you know, we just play this out over and over and over again. So they must, the invasion of evil calls forward. And this person tends not to be a member of the community or even have those community values, but they're there simply to fight evil. And they're possessed of some kind of superpower, right? Some advantage here that helps them to fight evil. Well, you can kind of see that when we playing out these political scripts, at least some part of the electorate believes that the corruption is so profound within Washington, right, and the swamp, that it must call for. So if you look at the number of, you know, we have tended not to. Now, the Democrats have, they almost always want to put a senator up, somebody who knows the government, right? But if you're anti-government, if you think that the government is inherently corrupt, you're looking for some sort of hero from outside. And Trump had all of that, just enough of that kind of identity to be scripted that way, right? He didn't come, he was not a politician. And that's one of the most commonly glorified aspects. Great, successful businessman, knows how business works. Well, you can, you know, fudge the data enough there, I guess, to make that claim. You certainly know how to make government pay off in terms of business. So it seemed.
Well, he was kind of coming in from, I mean, business was his other world that he was descending, you know, from over into politics to clean that up. And we've tried to use that character, that business, you know, world character a few times, like with Ross Perot, Steve Forbes, all these different guys.
They're exactly.
With Mark Cuban
people
now.
People from the outside, yeah.
You know, who can come in from the outside and clean up the ugliness, the moral ugliness.
I guess Nader is the Democrats' version of that, more of the critic of bureaucracy and right defender. So
when you see this,
not for business, but
impulses, like you see in this big communal sense in politics, but you also see it in the personal right now with personal psychodramas. Like everybody, it seems like in Austin, especially, is doing some type of self reformation and self, you know, redefinition. And it's interesting to watch what they poach through. There's a guy named Joe Dispenza right now who's poaching basically from physics and quarks and, you know, the whole language of theoretical physics and bring it over into personal reformation and, you know, personal healing and showing, like, you know, our thoughts control, like, affect, you know, us at an elemental level and, you know, all this sort of physics.
Are you talking about kind of self-help regimens that are being constructed by these? Yeah.
But it's been lifted out, you know, sort of as into people's personal stories where now, like, they're importing, you know, the story structures from something like physics, which you saw through, like, Stephen Hawking's and all the physics stories that have come out through, you know, through the years. And people take these little story fragments and they start trying to apply it to themselves personally as a narrative path.
Yeah, I have to say that because I wrote a book on therapeutic rhetoric and looking at exactly those kinds of things. I think that's been going on for some time, right? Any place you could find, you know, order to make narrative sense out of chaos. And essentially, when we start doing life narrative, we're looking for story form.
Yeah.
that leads to success or avoids failure, right? So, sure. When,
and I think that's what people are doing in a lot of ways, you know, the Trumpites, the people who have jumped on there, is that he has given that sort of disarrayed life a pattern, like a way for people to go, oh, well, there's power here. I can live my, you know, I can attach myself to the Trump symbology. And now everybody treats me different. Now I've got all these structures in place that nobody gave me any time before.
But that is, I think, what movement ideologies do. They explain your frustrations, your losses, your embarrassments to you in a way that lets you off the hook. In other words, we find a theory for what caused this. Oh, this is why it happened, because I'm this or that or the other. It gives you some place to blame and most importantly, something to work against, right? We have to find a way. It turns you into a protagonist.
Right.
And that's one of the great appeals of story is, right?
Yeah.
Agency.
Right.
It gives you
something. Subhero. And you see this again with the insurrection. People, once they got arrested, you could just see this befuddlement in their eyes. Like, how can you arrest me? I'm attached. Trump's my, you know, he told us to do this. Like, this is my cover. How could this be wrong? Because it gave him that sub identity where I'm a little version of Trump here and he keeps getting away with this stuff. How can you possibly indict me for it?
Yeah. I think you're imputing too much logic to it, but yeah, I mean, I don't know that those reasoning steps have to take place. Because I think they went into it believing that they were part of some sort of momentous, and the group think that behind that is we will succeed. And I think that's the shocker, is that, you know, and so as they sort of filled the steps of the Capitol and went through each door, there was this story was building in momentum that we're going to succeed here. Wow. Of course, the other side's going, well, you know, where's the National Guard? What do we just, somebody had to make a decision somewhere how this was going to end. And we noticed, you know, as soon as the National Guard poured, I mean, there weren't hundreds of people killed. I often muse, if you thought that was some sort of revolution, why don't you try that in Venezuela or try that someplace else and see how that works? It's a great testament to our humanity and lawlessness or lawfulness and also kind of the pure story nature of this, I guess, that as soon as they hit resistance, they start, you know, most of them at least start bailing.
We'll go back to what launched this discussion, you know, the story trope of mass destruction and big stakes, lots of death, lots of violence. That didn't happen. Like, they brought that, and there was, you know, elements of that. And I've watched the media, you know, like try to find any version of that, like make it find the most violent images possible, show it at its most violent.
Sure, absolutely.
Find any deaths that are even closely related to this, because that is, again, the story structure. But what's missing is, if you watch all the revolutionary stuff, I watched the trial of the Chicago 7 this weekend, you know, and in America's past, like the violence of meeting the protesters with violence and the earlier, you know, Black Lives Matter in Portland and Seattle and all those kind of responses, that's what we expect in that sort of political clash. But what we didn't see there was that super violent clash that sort of destroyed the narrative. And you've seen them now try to go back into it and say, well, this wasn't really a riot then or a insurrection because it wasn't violent enough.
Yeah,
but again, they didn't murder anybody. They didn't hang Pence. They didn't do any of that stuff. Ergo, we're going to reset the story as just some clowns kind of got out of hand.
Right. But yeah, the truth, whatever this is, has been lost in the ensuing reinterpretation, favorable reinterpretation.
Well, it becomes story.
And that was going on in the scandal over, you know, how many times did the Black Lives Matter protest? Our cities are burning. They burned our cities to the ground. Well, I mean, hell, a dumpster fire in, you know, Cleveland isn't exactly.
That's the logos issue again. Now you're looking for proof when they're just claiming story. And they don't have enough there to claim the story.
It is also the media issue, which needs a story to repeat over and over and over again, I guess.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see over time what happens with that insurrection story, because it is going to become this story battle of drain it of all its pathos and all of its danger and all this stuff. And there was a story yesterday about Pence starting his push for 2024 nomination. And he's instantly doing this. Like, he's instantly downplaying this. He's not talking about that they were after him or any of that stuff anymore. And so they've got to drain that story. Like, when I watch this, I'm like, okay, there's enough imagery here, right? There's enough riot imagery and enough horrific human imagery that this is going to stick. But who knows over time, like, if that story is going to have that potency to still be politically useful.
Well, and once again, the other side is moving on it, and it's not for nothing. I mean, it wasn't nothing that people were killed and that those things were said and done. The truth, the baby in that bathwater was lost some time ago. It seems seemingly. And all you're left with is the institutional machinery of the law, and who are the other actors, the Ted Cruzes, the Pences, they can't have Trump supporters and be part of the vilification of this and that.
Yeah, it's a tough position politically to be able to tell, which story are they going to tell? And this again is sort of what they're talking about with Pence, that he's going to try to walk that line of talking to the establishment while also appealing to the anti-establishment on the right. And how do you do that? Like, those two rhetorics have become incommensurate in a lot of ways.
Right.
Because one's so radical and one's so story-driven and conspiracy-driven and all that kind of stuff. How do you pay homage to that without losing everybody who has a semblance of rationality instead of storyality about it?
Well, one wants to live in a world, at least I do, that where whatever steps towards becoming president Pence might engage in are completely, have no possibility of traction, or Ted Cruz or any of those people. But, one has to wonder in their worldview, which must contain a strong dose of ambition, how that, I guess maybe Trump is a great example where if you just keep pitching and maybe things will ignite and you'll be cast.
Well, I think Trump, what I found with Trump is that, he ran for president all the way back from the 1980s. Like, he was trying to get into politics forever. It wasn't until the electorate got crazy enough, extreme enough, by integrating the Tea Party and all that kind of talk and all that rhetoric became normalized enough that his, the fact that he's a promoter and he will take any script and amplify it fit within that ideology enough to get him elected.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the story. Part of the rest of the story. And once again, all I know is what I read. I mean, is that there were false starts, and because he's got an ego the size of Jupiter, and that's easily appealed to. And if anybody were to say, there is the old interview with him going, "What, me president?" I mean, no, with my history with women, are you kidding? There was a time in which he was making very realistic assessments of the world.
Sure. Right?
And even as the story's told, even coming into 2012, even though he had dabbled there. So he wasn't, there wasn't this sort of single, and that would be unusual for him to have a single focused plan or strategy for success. Certainly he never did that in business. Even then there was a lot of ambivalence, and they still tell the story of, we did it largely as a marketing, a branding, building the brand. We didn't expect to win. If you read the first, parts of Bob Woodward's book, what other things had to happen? And Steve Bannon and his friend go to see Trump and decide, yeah, he could be the guy. So it may not have all emanated from Trump.
I don't think any of it.
There are other forces at work here, right?
I think Trump's a great surfer. Like, he just finds waves and he can stay on the board.
Pretty much. We need to come back to our talks and collect all the Trump metaphors. Trump the surfer, who's also the clown that steals the Porsche.
Yeah, I got a lot of them. So like, if you look at what's coming up, if you look at the, you know, the bullpen, so Kamala Harris, what's the story? Is her story powerful enough? Like, they told her story a lot coming up about, you know, female, and she was a prosecutor and she's multi-ethnic. And so they laid those story foundations. Do you see, is that strong enough? Because that's not monomyth in America, is it? I mean, the immigrant kind of, it's sort of just below monomyth.
Well, no, it's not the monomyth. I mean, there's only one of them. That's why we call it the monomyth. But it's got mythic portents.
Right.
It's got mythic portents. You know, I see a lot of that kind of political storying as after the fact, sense making after the fact. You know, you've got, there are story requirements that have to play, but our willingness to get on board of those stories and tout them as important, depends a lot on circumstance. So I think, you know, it's like Joe Biden as the healer in chief. I don't think that swayed many votes. I think that became an after the fact kind of advantage. Okay, you know, this is a good thing about him, but I don't think that there's really that significant a number of people who chose it on that basis. And in a way almost plays, is nullified on the other side, but those who want somebody with, you know, more fighting experience. So I think in a way those things are always offset. So in the case of Kamala and her identity as the first Asian, and, you know, once again, it has to always be expressed in this composite.
She's an amalgamized story, right?
Right. So that's just an advantage. That's just some testimony that will put anything in there that works. So she gets to be the first Black woman. She gets to be the first Asian woman. She gets to be the first female vice president. So she gets all of those things. For whom do any of those things become the salient criterion? So they just become things to say, in a way. They become goods that one can wear into this, but there's going to be others that I think probably the political realities weigh out, if that makes sense. So I think that points us to another function of story. It's not necessarily the driver, or at least for everybody, the driver. And so we can say story is important, and certainly it is for how we record and, you know, historicize these things. So there's different levels at which we need to story and use story sense-making patterns here without necessarily being completely causal. There's at least some research, as much as all of my work and theory stuff really deals in one way or another with story forms, but there's some research that suggests that in certain kinds of circumstances, lists of facts are more persuasive. And if you think about, you know, Bill Clinton was a savant really at marshaling facts. But, you know, so if you have strong facts, their stories are not stronger, but you still need a good story, okay? So he also did great personal stories, but his ability to bring facts to bear and make arguments was every bit as powerful in his rhetorical profile, if you ask me. It's for whom does this persuade, and what does it do? So facts can easily be forgotten or offset by, you know, and it's certainly if you were dealing with a population that doesn't trust anybody's facts, never checks them out. Stories have more, and, you know, they're loaded with preservatives. We talked about the quality of propaganda as one in which it kind of lives its own life out there, right? Independent of particular sources. Well, story has that capacity far more than, you know, even though some facts will kind of get repeated over and over again until they're no longer factual. Typically those get embedded in some kind of, you know, some kind of other story structure, it seems to me. So anyway, it's all part of the mix, if you ask me, in terms of that doesn't mean one can ignore it or we don't require it, because I think the final sale here is going to be how well can your story be endorsed. And those are all going to be bones of contention, as they have been about every other candidate. So the Trumpian story goes how far with, right? Was he a failed businessman? Was he this? Was he that?
Right. Well, it goes, it's that seesaw of villain hero, right? Villain hero.
Sure.
Like I'm trying to turn you into villain. They're trying to turn you into hero. And we're using the same plane to work on. Like his business, for example, like his business acumen or his, you know, the quality of himself as a businessman. And yeah, you'd want to import facts in there to be able to make that decision, but it doesn't seem, they seem very good at just skewing the facts, turning them into a hornet's nest instead of an organized line of bees, you know?
Well, and we talked at some length about how, you know, once again, just hurling confusion into it to sort of nullify. So Donald Trump, and he knows business, he understands business, he's for business. Well, experientially, I suppose all of that is at some level true. But then on the other side, he, you know, declared bankruptcy X number of times. He, before he was president, he was selling, you know, ties made in China and thin steaks.
He was right.
None of those factual conflicts makes any real sense. Apart from this larger dramatic competition, which is a drama that contains struggle over what is the story going to be, right? Who's going to control the narrative is a common thing to say here, right?
Well, so I like this idea of the story struggle, and Logos gets, you know, in there and tries to do its work, but let's just keep Logos out of it for now.
Well, that is Logos if you don't think about Logos just as pure logic, which I think was never the case. I think that, you know, if we go back to the history of this thing, it's only this kind of idealism of science and logic and philosophy that we quit looking at story structures as important as they are and started, you know, people should be persuaded by facts, right? So it is only that kind of sanitized view of this, of objectivity that even made us quit thinking this, that it would become somehow revelatory to return to the way most people do this psychological business of life, which includes, if you come from people like mine, a lot of story, right?
So, yeah. Anyway.
So I say story is in the Logos, if you will.
That doesn't fit with my 21 college separate theory.
And you are probably more mainstream in the use of those things than I am.
Yeah, I mean, my point for a lot of what I try to do with rhetoric is just to make it, I guess, consumable, you know, sure, within the sort of idea that if you really start going into the depth exploration of this stuff, it muddles and intermingles, and then you're in all sorts of problematic area for consumption learners. Sure. And so to me, like, I think it's just really useful to separate out a concept of story that people can go, oh, they're telling a story here. And like when we're talking about stories fight each other, like that as a concept is really useful rhetorically to most people. And I think when you look at Kamala Harris as having these story assets, I usually break it down in business to assets, liabilities, and deficits when I do analysis for this stuff. So you have story assets that can work for you. You have liabilities that everybody's going to try to put in there. And then you have deficits, like what is missing. And so I think with Trump, you know, whether he had the assets or not, like he would just add in, because he's a promoter. So he creates mythical assets and he's done it forever, because that's what promoters do when they're trying to sell a character or a show or whatever they're promoting. And so he had that ability to create mythical instant assets, which is, you know, pretty useful when you're not being judged on deception or truth as a criteria of your character. So when I look at, like, if we are advising, say we're advising Kamala Harris in 2028 or 2024 for president, what do we do with her story-wise that would dominate, you know, enough space to get her elected? You've got 30 seconds. Fix it.
I'm suspicious they're not going to call either one of us, but if they do, that
man, they need to call us. We're just sitting around.
But somebody's already doing this work, right? They are. I think they were already, you know, Biden's speech the other night storied Kamala Harris in a number of significant ways.
Well, they're She's doing a bit of doing these it projects, right? They don't have the terminology and the specific vocabulary of rhetoricians to go in and.
Well, but once again, a story plank was it was entered from the first line of Biden's speech. I'm the first president to say from this podium, Madam Vice President, right? And yeah, so
flipping the female character,
and so that is itself going to be item one. She is that, just as Hillary Clinton's was the most experienced woman to ever run, you know, to be or the first woman really to be have the candidacy of a major party. So that is a story to get on board of, right? And so and an interesting one to position here because. She can't be the first Black president and in a way needs to have a separate kind of ethos here. And so her credentials here as the first woman and are going to be a significant part of that. Because once again, not all stories are historical. They're also, right, they're trajectories. If you get on board of this, and I think Barack Obama is a great case of that. I think the momentum behind that certainly in terms of voter turnout and the support that he got. And I think that also was a story that advantaged the Biden-Harris team, right? That's enough. Certainly for Hillary Clinton too, I think a lot of her momentum was wanting to be part of the story of electing the first woman president. And that you talked about how do you climb on, you know, how do you find a story arc that gets above the fray of these other things? How do you transcend the 30 odd years of scandal and negativity about Hillary Clinton? Well, that did it for many people. Even though in a more subterranean way, I think that was equally an obstacle for many other people. The first woman president is a very threatening thing. So I think if you're thinking about this for Kamala Harris, there is a brute fact here about some part of the population is not quite ready for a female president. They cannot cast the woman in the role of leader because there's a psychology of leadership that, you know. So this is part of that bigger struggle.
Go back to the superhero stories, right? Dominated by men, just massively dominated by men. Like Wonder Woman kind of gets in there. And then they have to go in and they're actually going to the female villains, the strong villains, and just turning them into heroes like Black Widow. And they try to do it some with Catwoman because there's not enough strong female power to turn that into a superhero.
Right, right. Just, you know, the traditional, that tradition is, and I think we get that kind of conservative when we look at, you know, we have more female governors, I guess, than ever in history, more females in Congress than ever in history. So change is taking place, but I still think we're going to reserve, and we do bracket off the presidency as the sort of ultimate, and that we invest it with far more characterological power than, you know, that somehow good or bad emanates from this character is.
Yeah, right.
That, you know, it wouldn't really, you know, my advice to people would be quit thinking about this person, you know, what makes to me, Biden great is that he's smart enough to listen to a bunch of other people who know how government works and make good choices. It's not that his moral character or, you know, is what determines the success or failure of this at all. And quite on the other side, all of the irony and contradiction looking at Trump as this kind of super, you know, independent of what actually got done or who he worked for or who you know, gained advantage from his presidency. So this looking for the redeemer, this is back to the monomythic structure, right? And the fundamentally religious template, right? In the Judeo-Christian culture that we're playing over and over and over again. So there's a lot of narrative wiring that makes that happen. And it is gender, you know, based.
Yeah, and I think it's really important if you look at story infrastructure and story mechanisms to say, well, this is what we're starting with. This is what your population has been trained to. You're going to have to do some story work to get that character into that slot. You know, I look at with Captain Marvel, if you followed all the, you know, Marvel work, they got Captain Marvel as a female character, and she's so powerful. Like, she's more powerful than Superman. Like, in the Avengers story with Thanos and everything else, she showed up and she could have taken out Thanos like that. Like, she has so much power that she doesn't make for an interesting character anymore. Like, she literally shows up almost deus ex machina in that, changes the tide of the battle, and then goes, yeah, I've been busy doing other stuff, so I didn't really care about Thanos right now. I got a bunch of other work going on. But that, to make that move and turn that that female character into the ultimate power is an interesting story move if you can get people to accept it.
Sure,
because Wonder Woman just has bracelets and a lasso, and she's strong. I mean, she's not really Superman strong. She's not Batman. She's not a special.
They have her going shopping a lot. You know, it's a. This is what you give me, this female hero from a female culture, and what does she do? She goes shopping and looks really good in those clothes.
Yeah, they used a lot of the, you know, what you would consider to be the natural tropes from American females. But you also look at Margaret Thatcher as a political female who succeeded getting all the way to the top of the British system. But she had the kind of bona fides of cruelty. She was cold. She would do all these things that were almost beyond what the other conservatives were.
In a culture where they were queens.
Yeah, that's right. So you already had the story structures in place.
A queen had been reigning for some years, yeah. And almost, you know, a little offsetting of each other in those inflections of female persona. So,
Maybe that's what
I think if you wanted to step back and look at, and it's probably somebody is doing that kind of research, I would hope. What are all the ways that we have sort of slowly cast females into these roles, right? So, Madam Secretary, I think Gina Davis was a female president for a while.
Yeah, we've had a few stories where you've seen that, the female president.
So slowly they are populating, you know, and if you, it's once again, the fight against, you know, conservatism and tradition in these things, you almost have to go out of your way. How many female CEOs are there? How many female congresspeople? And over time, the more those things get enacted. But I think back to as I was, you know, doing some political consulting at the time where Geraldine Ferraro was the first female candidate. And it occurred to me at that time, boy, there is no one way to be here. How do you dress? You know, she had this incredibly puritanical, for the debates, this incredibly puritanical outfit on. So our sort of psychological casting really doesn't know how to do that. And if you look at, you know, controversy over Hillary Clinton's, how do you be the first, you know, contrasting at that time with, say, Sarah Palin, the whole thing about baking cookies, right? Hillary Clinton loses all kinds of points by saying, I'm not baking any cookies. And Sarah Palin has an entire national special where she makes cookies.
Yeah. Do you reject? I mean, do you add more masculinity into the character, or do you?
Well, that's another double trap, isn't it? And that's part of it. Carlin Coors Campbell in her early feminist rhetorical scholarship really looks at that the woman speaker is an oxymoron. Right, that's not being a woman to speak out in these male fora in these ways, making these kinds of arguments, because that has been completely masculinizing for thousands of years.
Well, I remember in the debates, you know, Kamala Harris had been had worked under Joe Biden, you know, in his for a while, and he called her kid in a very, not in a demeaning way, more in a like, hey, you know, come on, kid. Like this, he knew she was up to things, like she was good at things, but it was still patriarchal down, right? Or at least maybe lateral. I'm not sure. Like it, that's a trick.
Probably was not the best choice, right? To be.
And now when he's trying to add gravitas to her, you know, from, like you said, the address to Congress. How much gravitas is she going to need to take on in order to appeal to the conservative story, you know, that we've used to hearing?
Well, or I guess back to the game of politics, which maybe is outside of our realm, but is it even possible to do that? Is it even possible to appeal there? Are the liabilities simply so strong that then you have to figure out who your coalition is, who really are the persuadable ones here, and have they undergone sufficient transformation here? But change is happening. We have the first, you know, gay cabinet member, openly gay, I think. The first female vice president. So over time, these things, but that's just, you know, the truth about American culture.
Have you seen the trial of Chicago 7?
Yeah. Excellent. Excellent. Yeah,
there was really a great moment in there that I remember when Tom Hayden says, what bothers me is that forever people are going to think about you, the clown, you know, as the counterculture, counter-revolution here in from 60s politics, because you're up there in a striped, you know, American shirt, you're telling jokes and you're being crazy and outlandish. And that just takes the whole story away from the rest of us.
And to the Sacha Baron Cohen, who was playing the Abby Hoffman, and did an extraordinary job of it.
But when you look at that kind of power of character, and you've seen, it's so funny, this past week when Giuliani was in the news again because the FBI went in and raided his house, which I'm sure, come on, he's had 2 years to clean it out. But his son comes up and, you know, tries to defend him and immediately is throwing Hunter Biden again as a character. Like, they need a villain so badly to cover for their villains that Biden hasn't given them. I mean, where are the villains in this administration?
Well, I guess we only have 100 days. You have to trust that.
Villains will be found.
Villains will be created here, right? The law of conservation of villainy. This will be transferred to somebody sometime. But I think that's right. And I think they've done a good job of changing the game board here. And Biden's speech the other night, I think, was, I agree with the Bill Maher comment that clearly they were prepared to answer the speech that he didn't give. And he managed to navigate that extremely well. So it's encouraging that there is the possibility, and it's back to our subject matter. You know, it's back to rhetoric. How do you speak in a different way? I have some hopefulness that somehow this will just be a moment. These forces haven't gone away. I'm just not. You know, I guess the big fear here. I told you I was watching Peaky Blinders, which is really good stuff. But in the fifth season, and I watched it last night, they have a fascist. This is 1930 something in Britain, giving the fascist speech, and wanting to start the fascist revolution in England. So he's really before Hitler. But so much of his speech, and it was really beautifully written in terms of not only echoed Hitler, but echoed our contemporary. So even when he starts going into, and the news media will give you fake news, you know, clearly some stuff is being retrofitted back. Although Hitler did absolutely rail against, the press and these things, at any rate, but back to the point is that these templates are pretty longstanding, and those kinds of things to say have been around, and it's just a question. So at any rate, I guess where I was headed with that originally was that one worries about somebody coming along who isn't just such kind of a bumbler and a con man who's really, and I think there are people waiting in the wings to be that guy. Who could take this kind of rhetoric and, and animate it in more powerful ways. So it's dangerous to feel too good about defeating Trump.
Right. Well, what is that
Trumpism
to you? Like when you think
that,
I've heard that, you know, and they talk about Josh Hawley trying to get that and Cruz and Pence, they're all trying to grab that role. But what is that strong fascist-ish conservative hero look like? Like if it's not going to look like Trump, where it's just bombast and Trumpian, you know, he's his own thing. There'll never be another Trump. He had very unique background and they all came together. What does the next one look like? When you watch old newsreels of Hitler, you know, over animated, punch, everything, super emotional in his delivery, supposedly masculine, I guess. Like that's one of the things that they sold him as an uber male. Like who is that and what's it going to look like? You know, I remember in broadcast news, they used the line of, turns out that Satan, you know, isn't coming with a forked tail and red skin. He's just going to be a really good looking dude with blue eyes who's telling you the news. So is that what it's going to be? Just a very attractive, you know, a flamethrower kind of guy, or is there going to be somewhat moderate who can kind of appeal to that middle again? But still,
yeah. Well, I shudder. I don't want to do that work for anybody. The first coming,
so we know how to counter it.
How do we call it out when we see it? Is the question. How do you know it when you see it? Is the where we should be working? But just as you asked that question about Kamala Harris and her incipient presidential bid, how do you make over her narrative and her character in such a way that becomes a plausible right thing to get on board of? And as I'm sort of trying to footnote there, there's all kinds of other things that have to fall into place to make that to make that story sell. Somebody on the other side must be asking that same question: who's next? You know, can you really do Trump part two? Because so much, I think, has been rightfully and wrongfully dismissed as a cult of personality. And I guess what I'm saying is cautions one against writing that off, that this is all about him. To what extent? So somebody might
I don't think it was all about him. I think there's plenty of groundswell forces.
Right. They cast him. So who's the next person to do that? And, you know, I think your instincts are probably suggesting it is that person who will once again cross that fence, and that there are enough people in the middle who are not wary of that, who are looking for something, who will be free from the Trumpian success and failure. And maybe that person won't come along next time. Maybe it will be, you know, and maybe what will vault the next Republican president will be purely antipathy toward Democrats, liberals, Kamala, race, all of those things. You know, the negativity will line up sufficiently to that the Republican Party will kind of correct itself. You know, once again, talk about looking for a story.
Right.
I think that's they have to be. What is the phoenix that will rise from these ashes in terms of your traditional Republican? They interviewed John McCain's wife the other night, and that was, I guess that was on Colbert, wasn't it? She's saying she's hopeful that the Republican Party of John McCain will reform and survive this. So that all remains to be storied, if you will. Is that a long way around not to not answer your question?
Well, it's an unanswerable question. What I always look at is where are the chess pieces, you know, that you can move. And if we're going to line those up behind, you know, Kamala, if we're going to line those up behind Buttigieg, if we're going to line them up behind somebody who hasn't emerged yet, while the other side is lining up their, you know, dark pieces or whatever they're using, like, I just want to see as best I can the chessboard and tell people, sure. Hey, when you see this, when you see them pull up this, the way they'll go after Kamala Harris is in this way, like they'll attack the femininity of it. You know, as because it doesn't have a strong enough history in our story, our narrative structure. So we need to shore that up in a certain way. And to me, it's just this, you know, the chessboard is there. Most people just don't see the chessboard and they don't see the pieces. So let's lay out as many of those pieces as we can and say, this one's really important. You know, just have her do this over and over and over and over and over and over and over.
Right. Well, I don't know how far we've drifted from narrative, except that to say that these stories must survive and be shaped and prosper in the context of larger things. And so what the economy is doing, the interview with the Supreme Court justice that said, who sort of called out fascism ahead of time, said, you know, the real danger here is that somebody's going to come along and say, here, I will solve this problem for you. And so, you know, back to your original question, it's going to be somebody with that line who probably is a younger, more handsome, more politically experienced than Trump, but with a similar kind of appeal that seems like the solution, and there will be enough frustrated people to grab onto that story and that character, the plot and the character of that narrative, right?
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I don't see that talent on their side right now. I don't see anybody popping up. It's the guys like Tom Cotton and
nobody saw Trump coming either. So
yeah, but he came like as soon as he showed up, I knew it. I'm like, oh yeah, he's got the skills they need. That's all.
Well, maybe so, but you know, if you go back to those Republican debates, you know, there were what 13 people on the stage, and maybe the best group of Republicans ever. I mean, you know, moderates and Kasich and Jeb Bush and Hodges, the guy from Utah. Right? These were smart, experienced, middle of the road kind of people, and somehow they were just not appealing to the hunger of the mass at that moment, right? And I think clear up into, you know, almost October, thought people were thinking, there's no way Trump could win this, right? And in some sense, he really didn't in terms of the.
In the previous election, I saw, you know, Obama come in and take it from Hillary Clinton in sort of the same way that he embodied this character of innovation and progressiveness and all that stuff without the slander that they had laid into, you know, her character forever and ever and ever. So he didn't have the baggage, and he had all the sort of shining, you know, prince son coming up through the innovative progressive politics. So
sure.
I look at the right and I'm like, well, they need somebody then that can do that on that side. That's got those kind of bona fides.
Right.
But I don't see it.
Well, I think my opinion has always been that, Americans are deeply suspicious of legacy kinds of stories. So the wife of Bill Clinton, as much as that's a foot in the door, it was also a slamming of the door for many people. So I think, you know, I don't think the right has all the same, you know, the son of the race car driver, the son of the country music star. These people are all fine, right? So, I think they may see that as very different. But
well, cool, man. Again, once again, super fun. I like digging into a story like this and turning it into mechanisms, you know, that become useful for people to be able to adjust to get the effects that they want. And I've seen it again in entertainment. I see it in comedy and I see it in politics. And like you said, maybe next time we should talk about your therapeutic stuff, because that's such it always comes back to the fact that whatever the national stories are, people are still pulling them into their lives and using them as therapeutic structures. And so there was something about the Trump story that was therapeutic for those people. And knowing connectivity is super important.
Well, I think your insight that people are also working on their own story and with the tools that these larger rhetorical narrative strands offer them, right? And if it doesn't work for them as individuals, it doesn't work. I think that's the bottom line there. So how does this, you know, if anybody, and I tend to think that in our theorizing and accounting for all of this logic and objectivity and ideas and how they work, we have tended to not focus on this is just part of the environment in which people are making, you know, sense of things to seek their own success. And so you've got to look at the phenomenology of the individual and what how they can use these stories themselves. So
Well, let's talk about that next time. One of the other Colosseums is the Pathos, you know, the Psyche. So there you go.
They're really all part of the same thing.
Yeah, they all
come to find out.
Just very useful to look at them as different campfires. So instead of one big bonfire. So, well, we'll come back around next time. Again, appreciate it. Super fun. And go out there and tell people stories, since they clearly make up their minds using them. This is Rhetoric Warriors. We'll be back.